This series of lectures on C.G. Jung and the tradition of Gnosis was delivered at the C.G. Jung Institute, Zurich, on February 4th, 5th, and 6th of 2013. The lectures are given by Dr. Lance Owens. The first lecture in the series is titled, The Hermeneutics of Vision. These three lectures are dedicated to the subject of Jung and the tradition of Gnosis. I've divided it into three sections. The first lecture tonight is called The Hermeneutics of Vision. The lecture tomorrow is called The Father of the Prophets. And then on Wednesday, we'll talk about the Prophet's Bride. So, The Hermeneutics of Vision. In an interview that was published coincident with the publication of the Red Book in October of 2009, Dr. Sono Shamdasani was asked to foretell ways in which the publication of the Red Book would affect the understanding of C.G. Jung in coming years. And Shamdasani prophetically summarized the situation in these words. Quote, "The publication of Liber Novus will be seen to mark a caesura comparable to the effect of the publication of the Nag Hammadi Library on the study of Gnosticism. Finally, one is in the position to study the genesis of Jung's work and what took place in him during this critical period based on primary documents." Unquote. So when I read those words 3 years ago, I found myself smiling broadly. And I imagined dear Dr. Jung laughing broadly at this mysterious conjunction, the synchronous juxtaposition of the Gnostic Gospels and Liber Novus. These primary documents, separated by two millennia, share a common root and vision. And Dr. Jung knew that. While still composing Liber Novus, Jung saw his experience mirrored in these ancient Gnostic texts. In 1915, he saw this. There is a dialogue between these two sets of primary documents. Together, Liber Novus and the Gnostic Gospels direct attention to a creative, imaginative, and mythopoetic experience underlying their singular tradition. The Gnostic manuscripts from Nag Hammadi and Jung's Red Book jointly confront us with a task of comprehending human imagination, human vision, an experience of human vision. For most of the last century, Jung's great enigma was his veiled Red Book and the journal records he kept during that most crucial period of his life. So with the publication of Liber Novus, the Red Book, in 2009, and now forthcoming publication of the Black Books in the next few years, Jungian studies have entered a new epoch. Liber Novus was at the center of Jung's life and work. The experiences which produced Liber Novus, the Red Book, were, as he proclaimed them, the numinous beginning which contained everything. In a dramatic and parallel way, a transformation has occurred in the study and understanding of Gnosticism. The discovery in 1945 at Nag Hammadi in Egypt of a large cache of ancient Gnostic manuscripts, Gnostic scriptures, has kindled a major reevaluation and a metamorphosis in the assessments of Gnosticism and the origins of the Christian age. And of course, in the early 1950s, Dr. Jung and this institute were instrumental in acquiring and making available the first example of the texts found at Nag Hammadi. You guys know this stuff? No, you don't. Okay, the lecture might go 75 and a half minutes then. Yeah, the documents were found in Egypt in 1945, and they were taken home by the Bedouin tribesmen that found them and thrown in the corner of the house, and they started using the back pages to kindle the tea for the afternoon, and then somebody decided to take them to the black market in Cairo. And these were beautifully bound in gazelle leather. I mean, their codices are ancient bound books. And they had some value on the black market, and one of them was smuggled into Europe. And a scholar by the name of Hiles Quispel, a Dutch scholar who had spent World War II holed up in his room studying Gnosticism and Valentinus, heard that this document, original Gnostic texts, were on the black market. And they wanted 10,000 francs, Swiss francs. So Quispel had already met Jung. He had known Jung for about 6 years because they were both interested in Gnosticism. Quispel went to Jung, and through the offices of individuals associated with the institute, this institute, 10,000 Swiss francs were acquired. Quispel met the salesman in a train station in Brussels, picked up the first copy of these ancient texts. And you know who this was presented to as a birthday present? Dr. Carl Gustav Jung. Okay.
It's a birthday present?
Huh?
He called it the birthday present?
The manuscript was presented to Dr. Jung in 1952 on his birthday as a present. Okay? This codex is still known. It's codex number one. There are 13 of these volumes that were found at Nag Hammadi. This is called the Jung Codex. In Gnostic studies today, this is called the Jung Codex. And by the way, I'll say Gnostic. In German, you say Gnosis, right? Yeah? So, but Americans skip the K. We just go with Gnosis. So, that's me. So, Hiles Quispel was a scholar of Gnosticism, very famous. And Quispel told the story of sitting with Jung out in the tower at Bollingen in 1955 with his first efforts at translating this text, the Nag Hammadi first codex. And he told the story of sitting there reading to Jung the first translations of the Gospel of Truth from the Codex 1. And Jung listening to him and pounding his fist and saying, "This is the original experience. This is the original experience." Okay? But the collection and the translation of this entire collection of codices, I mean, even getting all 13 codexes together in one place, you know, off the black market and all, was a process that took over a quarter century. And it was not till 1977 that the entire corpus of material was published as the Nag Hammadi Library. And these are the now famous Gnostic Gospels. But the translation, the annotation, and the contextualization of this literature, this ancient Gnostic literature, found in Nag Hammadi, is a work now maturing, but still it is a work in progress. In 2007, just 5 years ago, the newly translated, annotated, and vastly improved international edition of the Nag Hammadi scriptures appeared. And this is really, this very recent edition, is really the first truly felicitous, truly good translation and presentation of all of these texts together. These primary documents of the ancient Gnosis. So, a couple of decades ago, when I'd give lectures like this on Gnosticism, I just sort of assumed that no one had ever heard of it or knew much about Gnosticism. And few educated people did 30 years ago. when I first started talking about this stuff. But that has dramatically changed. Over the last 30 years, the subject of Gnosticism has really reached a level of incipient collective cultural awareness. Dozens of scholarly works, dozens, and dozens of popular works on Gnosticism have now been published, and a few of them have become bestsellers, including the works of Dr. Elaine Pagels at Princeton. The rediscovered Gnostic Gospels and the role of the Gnostics in the complex story of early Christianity have been the subject of many television documentaries now. For instance, the National Geographic Society's big production about the Gospel of Judas, right? That's a primetime example of what I'm talking about. And in America, every year around Easter time, these documentaries and rebroadcasts of the documentaries appear in great profusion, great plethora of them, around Easter week. Does that happen in Europe? I don't know. Is that European television do that stuff? Maybe it's just the American stuff. And look at the alembic of modern cinema, the creative alembic of modern cinema. Critics increasingly comment on Gnostic things. For example, the movie The Matrix. I suspect most of you have seen The Matrix. You've been red pill, blue pill, right? Many commentaries and reviews have looked at this as an imaginative restatement of the key myth of Gnosticism, the myth of the Demiurge. It is. Another example, the Da Vinci Code. Blockbuster book and movie. And it aroused this incredible collective libido, interested in hidden, secret ancient texts from the origins of Christianity, a suppressed feminine archetype and real woman, and a mystery of a sacred conjunctio. Yeah? That was all in there, wasn't it? For 18 years, I've run an internet web library dedicated to collections of primary Gnostic texts, including all of the Nag Hammadi library and everything associated with it online. When the Da Vinci Code came out, the volume on my website just went through the ceiling. Absolutely through the ceiling. You get this text on I've had this metric. You know, we like metrics, I suppose, sometimes in psychology, not much in Jungian psychology, but, I've got this metric, of sort of cultural interest in Gnosticism. So you get an article in all the world newspapers about the wife of Jesus text. You heard that one, didn't you? The wife of Jesus text goes up. My internet accesses to this webpage. And, I'm talking like 5 million checkouts a year of these documents. I'm not talking about 10,000. I'm talking about 5 million a year. And you know the one text that's most looked for? Number one text? Since the Da Vinci Code, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene. Number two, the Gospel of Thomas. And when the wife of Jesus stuff comes up, accesses to the Mary Magdalene, we're talking 100,000, like that. Okay. So this stuff is penetrating into the culture. And 3 years after its publication, dear Dr. C.G. Jung's The Red Book, Liber Novus, with sales now over 100,000 copies worldwide, also seems to have touched something in the collective psyche. So, both facts suggest to me it's a time that we all of us interested in Jung, take a look again at Jung and the tradition of Gnosis. Christianity and the new God image. 2,000 years ago in the Western world, a new religion began to take form. With it came a new myth, new symbols, and a new divine image. That is an historical observation. History witnesses that it did happen. And today, Western culture stands in the shadow of that event. Why a new religion constellated in that distant age one might think would be a subject for extremely hypothetical historical causalities. It would be an affirmation of creedal belief, and that's about it. How do you explain that? Why? A new religion constellated, however, was considered by Jung. And Jung offered insights into this event drawn from an entirely different provenance. One can approach Jung's expressed views as, well, interpretive insights, psychological analysis, myth, or madness, if you wish. In whatever fashion Jung's comments are categorized or critiqued, it has to be recognized that C.G. Jung saw a story revealing itself in this history 2,000 years ago. In brief version, Jung envisioned symbols of an aeonial, an epical transition of consciousness emerging within that crux cultural moment 2,000 years ago. An old epic was ending. Antique Hellenic, Egyptian, and Semitic god images and their symbolic expressions developed over a prior couple of millennia no longer provided adequate channels for the living stream of the psyche in that day. A great interior force or libido had been pent up too long. This is Jung's story, right? I'm condensing this. This is what Jung said. Psychic contents were demanding expression in a new and living symbol. A power from the depths was erupting. From deep fissures, there burst forth a new spring of life. It was a kairos, Jung's word. And it bore a divine child, which morphed and matured over many subsequent centuries into what we now recognize as the Christian tradition, the Christian religion, a dominant, if not the dominant force in Western culture for 2,000 years since. At least that is how Dr. Jung told this tale. Historical records document that during that distant age of dissolution and reformation, there existed widely dispersed and heterodox groups of individuals who were called by their critics and who sometimes called themselves gnostikoi, in Greek, Gnostics. They did not apparently view themselves, however, as cultists or sectarians. They saw themselves as participants, full participants, within the formational visions of this new religion, whatever it would be. For some of these visionaries, the man called Jesus of Nazareth was not the singular focus. For some of them, it was Simon Magus. For some, it was Seth, or Hermes, thrice great, Hermes Trismegistos, in the Hermetic tradition of Egypt, a tradition with scant historical record, but a very rich textual tradition, which is deeply influential when it was rediscovered during the Renaissance in the court of Cosimo de' Medici. Gnostics authored a variety of visionary and mythic accounts with complexly interwoven motifs and several common keynotes. In the textual manifestation of their mythopoetic, myth-making imagination, they apparently sought expression of an experience termed by them gnosis, a perceptual knowing of timeless reality. Perceptual knowing. Beginning in the late 2nd century, patristic, the fathers of the church, patristic writers of the faction that eventually became orthodoxy, identified the gnosis and its literature as perversions of what they understood to be the Christian message. In their critiques, gnosis came to imply heresy, and a Gnostic was a heretic. By the 4th century, Gnostic texts, Gnostic gospels, manuscripts, mythopoetic literature, were effectively anathematized and they were actively destroyed. They, in fact, were thought completely lost to history until 1945, when they were found. Over 1,500 years or 1,600 years earlier, probably around the year 390 to 400, a large sealed jar had been buried in the Egyptian desert. In it had been placed, carefully placed, 13 bound books called codices of ancient Gnostic texts. It is supposed that they had been buried there by monks from a nearby monastery. St. Pachomius had a monastery near this place, Nag Hammadi, and it is supposed that the texts had been hidden there to avoid their destruction under Orthodox edict, which had been promulgated at that time. And there they were, awaiting us. Synchronicities. Now, by chance, they are found. So, okay, what is a Gnostic? The Gnostics asserted the centrality of what Dr. Marvin Mayer, who is the late Dr. Mayer, he died last August, the editor and translator of the Nag Hammadi scriptures, and perhaps the foremost authority in this field, what Dr. Mayer calls a mystical experience. This was Dr. Mayer's first key conceptual element in the definition of the Gnosis. It was a human experience. But historical or academic terminology finds it impossible to conceptually circumscribe the nature of a mystical experience or an introverted experience or an intrapsychic event, right? And this has been a stumbling block for Gnostic studies. The primary event motivating the Gnostic hermeneutics, the Gnostic interpretation of events, stands outside the extroverted conceptualizations of academic study. As Dr. Alfred Ribby of the Institute here noted in a very important book he published in 1999 on this subject, to understand Gnosis, one must understand the nature of its introversion in concert with its extroverted manifestations. But you see, that half of human experience, that stands outside scholarly apparatuses of investigation. It's sort of the Pandora's box. As historically and textually witnessed, this event, or insight, or introverted experience, was termed by these people gnosis, knowing something. And this motivated Gnostics to compose and to embrace as meaningful mythic and visionary tales. Often these writings took the form of complex and highly symbolic cosmogonic, making cosmos myths, okay? Origins of cosmos, prominently including a female figure called Sophia, Lady Wisdom, the feminine image of wisdom, indwelling cosmos, in matter, in life. Many texts start with actually an account of a vision. Some take the form of homiletics. Others read like dreams or like active imaginations. And some of these texts, are sort of a mishmash of all three. The Gnostic writers were apparently prolific, although we still have only a scant remnant of their writings. Irenaeus, who was the bishop of Gaul in the late 2nd century, and a passionate heresiologists, they're called technically, one of the advocates against heresy, Irenaeus of the late 2nd century commented sarcastically that the Gnostics did not consider one mature until he or she was composing such texts daily. Once again, it sort of sounds like that new analysand checked into the Hotel Zona about 1936. Or trying to get into the psychology club. Well, are they doing active imagination? Are they having dreams? That was a bit like, I'm creating analogies here, which may be historically inappropriate, but that's sort of the stuff that Irenaeus was complaining that these Gnostics were doing. Gnostic studies, let me just talk about that a minute. In 1996, Bentley Layton, who's a professor at Yale University, stated that Gnostic writings were mythic in literary character and composed pseud-epigraphically. Pseud-epigraphically, that means they were written in the name of a more ancient voice, attributed to a more ancient voice and not the writer's own. He notes that Gnostic writings did not address 2nd or 3rd century theological controversies, the questions of the age. What did they address? They addressed rather eschatological and metaphysical events and relationships. In 2005, 7 years ago, Dr. Marvin Mayer added an essential amplification to that statement. He said that in Gnostic writings, and I quote, "the story is as much a story about psychology as it is about mythology or metaphysics." End quote. So, Gnostic myth is a story about psychology. Now, coming from the leading academic author in this field, the author of probably 20 books on Gnosticism, the general editor of the international edition of the Navajoati Scriptures, published, and main translator of these texts, published 5 years ago, that affirmation is a transformational statement about the root of Gnostic tradition. And if these ancient manuscripts reveal themselves as a story about psychology, where in the modern world, where do you find a hermeneutics, an interpretive approach, or an analog of that psychology? Where? Dr. Karen King is a professor at Harvard University. She argued in her expansive and really very influential critique of prior studies of Gnosticism, which was published back in 2003, that scholars need to abandon all the old dogmatically influenced molds and methods of categorizing Gnosticism. It was more important, she stated, that we look at what these people were doing. What was their hermeneutics of text and experience? And in 1999, Dr. Ribby, here at the Institute, published really a signal study on the subject of Jung and Gnostic tradition. It's titled Die Suche nach eigenen Wurzeln in German, The Search for One's Roots. Unfortunately, it was not published in an English translation. In his study, Dr. Ribby suggested that C.G. Jung offered essential insights into the issue faced by scholars of Gnosticism. The two fields should be in dialogue. And I fully agree. And it may actually even be happening. Jung knew the experience that animated Gnosis. Far in advance of the scholarship of his own time, Dr. Jung offered a key to the understanding of Gnostic vision and mythology and psychology. Dr. Jung called the Gnostics the original depth psychologists. Okay? Alright. So before I talk more about the Gnostic stuff, the subject is Jung and the tradition of Gnosis, I have to talk a little bit more about Dr. Jung's experience. In November of 1960, 7 months before Dr. Jung died, He wrote these words, this letter, to an analyst in England. And I will read his letter. Quote, I had to understand. I was unable to make people see what I am after. I am practically alone. I am practically alone. There are a few who understand this and that, but almost nobody sees the whole. I have failed in my foremost task, to open people's eyes to the fact that man has a soul, and a buried treasure is in the field, and that our religion and philosophy are in a lamentable state. I have failed in my foremost task. End quote. C.G. Jung, November 13th, 1960.
Can you repeat the quote?
I can. I had to understand that I was unable to make people see what I am after. I am practically alone. There are a few who understand this and that, but almost nobody sees the whole. I have failed in my foremost task, to open people's eyes to the fact that man has a soul and there is a buried treasure in the field, and that our religion and philosophy are in a lamentable state. End quote. So, a few understand this and that, but almost no one sees the whole. Was Jung correct? Is that where we have been in our past understanding of C.G. Jung? Or not? Or does it even matter anymore? That's a question you have to ask. Does it even matter? If it does matter, it matters to me, if it does matter, the publication of Liber Novus in 2009 has given us the critical piece of the puzzle that we previously lacked. To many readers, it is now apparent that Liber Novus is the key text to the whole of Jung's work. After confronting Liber Novus, it is impossible to return to Jung's major writings without hearing its echoing voice. And I will testify to you on that. I've spent the last 3 years with Liber Novus and doing extended seminars with groups of therapists in my own home city and returning to the collected works. In the process, believe me, reading the collected works after you've spent a lot of time with Liber Novus is an entirely new experience. And I say that after 30 years of working with the collected works. Beginning in 1913, Dr. Jung took one of the most extraordinary voyages of discovery in record. He found a passage in division, and then he entered. He brought back a record of the story he met. This is his documentary record. It is the fictive fact disclosed in Liber Novus. As Jung stated to Frau Jaffe, it is the numinous beginning which contained everything. Jung fully understood that his own experience, partly disclosed in Liber Novus, were in quality and intensity very rare events. He wrote in mid-1919, speaking of visionary works, and undoubtedly referring to his own journey of the past 6 years, these words. This was written in mid-1919. Quote, these are borderline phenomena that overstep the norm. It is always only a few who reach the rim of the world where its mirror image begins. End quote. Near the end of his life, he's quoted in Memories, Dreams, Reflections as having said, now, this is a longer quote, let me read it all. If you've read Memories, you'll remember this. It appears to be a risky experiment or a questionable adventure to entrust oneself to the uncertain path that leads into the depths of the unconscious. It is considered the path of error, of equivocation, and misunderstanding. Jung goes on saying, I am reminded of Goethe's words. Now let me dare to open wide the gate, past which men's steps have ever flinching trod. He continues, the second part of Faust, too, was more than a literary exercise. It is a link in the aurea catena, the golden chain, aurea catena, which has existed from the beginnings of philosophical alchemy and Gnosticism down to Nietzsche's Zarathustra. Unpopular, ambiguous, and dangerous, it is a voyage of discovery to the other pole of the world. A voyage of discovery to the other pole of the world. Like Goethe's Faust, Jung saw his own Liber Novus was not an aesthetic or literary exercise. It too was a link in this golden chain of which he spoke, the aurea catena, reaching from the beginnings of Gnostic vision at the initiation of the Christian aeon 2,000 years ago, forward to his own revelation of a new aeon now in formation. And this is what he said in Liber Novus. This is what he said. Quote, to give birth to the ancient in a new time is creation. This is the creation of the new, and that redeems me. Salvation is the resolution of the task. The task is to give birth to the old in a new time. It belongs to the essence of forward movement that what was returns. Yet the meaning does not lie in the eternal recurrence of the same, but in the manner of its recurring creation at any given time. The meaning does not lie in the eternal recurrence of the same, but in the manner of its recurring creation at any given time. Placed in the context of his life work, Liber Novus opens a critical perspective on Jung's hermeneutics, his interpretive reading of the empirical records of the psyche. This is the enterprise that connects alchemy and hermeticism with the ancient tradition he identified as a primal root of both, the tradition of Gnosis. Much of Jung's work can be read as a hermeneutics of vision, an interpretive vocabulary that confronts symbols and images from the depths. Jung had personally experienced this otherness, or so he proclaimed, or so the record seems to represent. It was the infinite inner world he declared to be one half of our wholeness. Union with it was individuation, the summation and fullness of the self. The guiding light in his enterprise, the light that directed towards this mysterium conjunctionis, was his own odyssey into visionary reality. As Jung repeatedly said, the psyche is real. Real. And as I also repeatedly said, and he says it in answer to Job, no one seems to understand me when I say it is real. And collective unconscious? real. And you know what? It don't have no bottom. It's not like Freud's cellar. You go down to the cellar, there's a floor there, collective unconscious. When you're speaking of the collective, unconscious, ain't no bottom. Infinite. Primal infinite. That is what Dr. Jung said. Okay. Hermeneutics and anagoge. I'm going to scare you away just by saying those two words, I know, okay? I've repeatedly used this arcane and this seemingly theological word, hermeneutics. For a couple of decades, it seemed to me that this old word is the key to the greater whole of Dr. Jung's work. Jung's approach to creative vision was unique in his time, and it remains a potentially transformative reading of human creativity and also of the religion-making instinct. Within the word hermeneus, the Greek word, or hermeneut, as we say now, which means interpreter, and hermeneutics, which means the art of interpretation. Within those words resides the symbolic image of who? Hermes. Hermes. The interpreter and messenger between realms, above and below, gods and men. The ithyphallic deity at the crossroads between realms. Hermes was the symbol at the crossroads, right? The little herm, the little stone, was at the crossroads of ancient Greece. Jung had experientially encountered this mercurial archetype. In late summer of 1915, a year and a half into his experience that became Libra Novus, Philemon appeared to him and declared to Jung, "Hermes is your daimon. Hermes is your daimon." That's not in the red book. It's actually in black. It's in the black book. But Dr. Shamdasani adds that quote in the footnotes in Libra Novus just to let us know what the rest of that quote was. Of course, in tradition over the last 1,000 years, this art of hermeneutics, it's been associated with theology. Ugh, theology. Classic theological discussions of the hermeneutical art were worked primarily within a horizontal dimension, almost a semiotic dimension of historical, ethical, moral, allegorical types of readings, right? But a fourth mysterious type of hermeneutics was forever noted in medieval commentaries. And this was called anagoge, the fourth magic technique of interpretation.
Can you say that word again?
Yeah, it's a hard one. I only spell it A-N-A-G-O-G-E. And although I say it anagoge, I have never heard another human being say that word out loud. So, I might be saying it entirely wrong. I could also say anagoge, but I don't know. Oh, there you have it. So, this was a sort of the secret method of interpretation that existed in medieval manuscripts. Dante Alighieri wrote a letter to the Con Grande della Scala about his Divine Comedy. And he talks about hermeneutics, the modes of hermeneutics. The fourth mode of hermeneutics that Dante mentions in his letter to Con Grande della Scala is the anagogical mode. It's the magic fourth key of interpretation. So what is it? The Greek term anagoge means to lift up or elevate. Hermeneutics in the anagogical mode cleaves the timely dimension of ethical, of historical and allegorical readings. Those are all sort of semiotics. One thing represents another thing within the true realm, within this experienced realm. It cleaves it with this fourth technique. And this technique reads symbolic meaning the original fact veiled behind words. Its methods verge perpetually on the visionary. It reads through text, beyond text, seeking the primary vision that was formed into text. It affirms that there was an experience of visionary depth behind the text. And it attempts to evoke that vision. Jung's hermeneutics should be understood in this sense. It is anagogic. It doesn't read words alone. It's looking for the experience underneath text. In Liber Novus, Jung is a connection, a nexus between two worlds, inner and outer, hidden and seen, conscious and unconscious, above and below. He was figuratively a messenger at the great crossroads, known only to the few, the wayfaring men. And this was the place of Hermes, his daimon. In 1916, as Jung was still working on the manuscripts of Liber Novus, he called his new approach to fantasy, creative imagination, vision. Use the words you wish, he used all three. He called his approach to this the hermeneutic method. And in 1935, and again later, as recorded in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, actually, he compared his interpretive approach to anagogic interpretation. Those are his words. But noted that he preferred the expression synthetic hermeneutic interpretation. In Liber Novus, right at the end of Liber Primus, Jung felt this intense need to return to the Middle Ages. In the creation of the Red Book, in word and image, on parchment and paper, Jung was connecting to a type of anagogical hermeneutics that was last represented in medieval manuscript traditions of the 11th and 12th century. Dante, Wolfram von Eschenbach, and Parsifal, Meister Eckhart, were all part of this tradition. And when Jung heard their voices, when he read their texts, and you'll find this throughout his collected works, when he heard their voices, when he read their texts, what did he find? The vision, the primal experience underneath the word. This is the way Jung reads literature. It's the way he read Faust. It's what he saw in Nietzsche. It's how he looks at Meister Eckhart. It's how he looks at the alchemical literature. He talks about Dante in this way in his writings. When he talks about the Shepherd of Herma, very important in much of his writing, he's looking not at text, he's looking at a fact of human experience which had a visionary, imaginative, myth-making quality in it. And you know what people used to bring him every day in analytic sessions? Their own, just such material. And where did it come from? How do you form an image from dream into a painting, into a text? Isn't that an interpretive act? Aren't you engaged in the crystallization, the hermetic, interpretive act of bringing an experience to a form? And in that act of bringing the experience to form, we think that we're finding meaning, deeper insight. Yeah? I mean, if Jungian analysis, if analytic psychology doesn't involve those sorts of things, I don't know what the hell analytical psychology is. Okay. So, here we have Dr. Jung. Jung's first hermeneutic task. Was the interpretation of his own visionary experience. In the winter of 1913, starting on November 12th, 1913, through 1914, C.G. Jung says he stepped to the rim of the world where, as he later declared, the mirror image begins. Okay? He called it a voyage of discovery to the other pole of the world. And he explains, as reported in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, I quote, "The knowledge I was concerned with still could not be found in the science of those days. I myself had to undergo the original experience. And moreover, try to plant the result of my experience in the soil of reality. Otherwise, they would have remained subjective assumptions without validity." In 1948, he described what had happened to him, to his dear friend, Father Victor White, in a letter. He said to Victor, "I wanted the proof of a living spirit, and I got it. Don't ask me at what price." Yeah? Does that give you a feel of what this man was going through? Don't ask me at what price. You'll find Jung makes frequent mention of Paul, the Apostle Paul, in his writings. The Pauline vision on the road to Damascus, right? It's quite clear that Jung felt that what had happened to him had some equivalency there in what had happened to Paul, that metanoia of seeing something that changes you. The original experience and living spirit of the depths had led him to what he declared in 1916 to be, quote, a new spring of life. But from the very beginning of his odyssey in October 1913, Jung struggled with a rare task. What was it? Translating this imaginative encounter, his visions, his creative imaginations, into word, into form, into image. The translators of the Red Book, Liber Novus, comment on this in the introduction, the translator's note. They say, quote, "At the outset of Liber Novus, Jung experiences a crisis of language. The spirit of the depths, who immediately challenges Jung's use of language, along with the spirit of the time, informs Jung that on the terrain of his soul, his achieved language will no longer serve. The theoretical, the didactic," end quote, "the theoretical, the didactic, and discursive forms of his previous scientific jargon would not carry the fact of this experience." Jung confronts the challenge before him in his introduction to Liber Novus, and this is what he said. He makes this petition to you, the reader of Liber Novus, quote, "My speech is imperfect. Not because I want to shine with words, but out of the impossibility of finding those words, I speak in images. With nothing else can I express the words from the depths." End quote. Near the end of his life, Jung spoke of the visions as the, quote, "fiery magma out of which the stone that had to be worked was crystallized." The fiery magma out of which the stone that had to be worked was crystallized. Jung's first task, and again, this is what I would call his primary task, his primary hermeneutic, interpretive task, was to crystallize a stone out of this stuff. That stone, the fact he would work the rest of his life, originated in a protein, visionary experience, which played out over several years. It was a descent into mytho-poetic, myth-making imagination. He was compelled to give this experience expressive form. And early in the experience, the prophet Elijah had appeared to him and had said, I quote, "Seek untiringly, and above all, write exactly what you see." That's what Elijah said But how would he put in words the fictive facts of this experience, of these visions? In response to this, Jung entered an intensely focused and deeply considered interpretive hermeneutic activity, process. The voice of the depth spoke in images and symbol, and so in translating his experience did C.G. Jung. Even the graphic form of words on the page needed to speak with this voice of image. Jung further intuited that the experience he had was not unprecedented. Not unprecedented. But rather somehow linked with previous human history. With a fact that had existed as lived experience earlier in history. Where and how it had existed must have been pretty ambiguous at the beginning of 1913, 1914, as Jung began the Red Book. Nonetheless, with parchment and paint, and with archaic calligraphic pen, he had to bridge with word and with image this huge chasm in time, linking past and present and future. And this process, it unfolded in a dynamic progression. As the transcription proceeded, parchment sheets changed to paper pages in the Red Book. The artistic images he created in the Red Book became more expressively abstract. The calligraphic handwriting became less cramped, a bit more fluid. And finally, around 1917, 1918, a unifying symbol began to come out of this, a living symbol. What was its form? What did it look like, this living symbol? It looked like a cross and a circle. That's the simplest way he describes it, a circle and a cross. Okay? And these started to come in August of 1917. They have some pictures of his notebooks, actually, in the back of the Red Book. And they've been on display, the actual pages from his... he was a commandant at the prisoner of war camp at that time. And he was writing on his office stationery there in his tent in the prison camp, or internment camp for British and French soldiers. His sketches, these were his first mandalas. And then in 1919, he crystallizes on a page in Liber Novus an image, a mandala, which he calls the Philosopher's Stone. Mm-hmm. This is at least 10 years before Jung started studying alchemy in any intense fashion. Okay? There it is, the Philosopher's Stone. So in sum, Liber Novus reveals these temporal strata. But it is all stone crystallized from one same source. This was Jung's primary hermeneutics of vision. A mini-layered working of vision formed to image. By late 1914, as the first draft of Liber Novus took form, Jung recognized that what he had experienced was more than personal. More than personal. It was epical. It was of import to others. And commenting on this, the signal imaginative creation, these types of creative acts across the ages, in 1930, he stated that great imaginative art, and I quote, draws its strength from the life of mankind. And we completely miss its meaning if we try to derive it from personal factors. And I would use this as a key to looking at Liber Novus. You cannot derive this entirely from personal factors. It's an error to do so. And he continues, whenever the collective unconscious becomes a living experience, and is brought to bear upon the conscious outlook of an age, this event is a creative act which is of importance for a whole epoch. A work of art is produced that may truthfully be called a message to generations of men. This is effected by the collective unconscious when a poet or seer lends expression to the unspoken desire of the times and shows the way, by word or deed, to its fulfillment. C.G. Jung, in those words, in 1930, was speaking in kind of his own hidden new book, the primary translation to word of vision, a multifaceted layering of word in image, image in word, reaching backward and forward in time. A creative act which is of importance to a whole epoch, a message to generations of men. Those were his words. Okay. So this is that primary creative act, right? But in the 1920s, early 1920s, Jung is still working on transcribing Liber Novus. You know, the events happened, a draft was written, then he spent more than 16 years putting this stuff into the Red Book. By the 1920s, even while he was still transcribing this manuscript into the Red Book, into his big red folio, he knew this complex crystallization of his experience would not be understood. Seems like a lot of people are having a heck of a time understanding it now. It would have been a lot worse then. So, how could anyone understand what he was doing? What the dear doctor was doing? Where was the method apt at interpreting such an enterprise? Yeah? So he had this event. He crystallized it into a book, which no one would understand. So what's next? He has to develop a vocabulary, actually, of understanding what he's been doing. He has to develop a secondary, shall we say, a second layer of his interpretive art, of his hermeneutics, of his way of reading human imagination. He has to talk about this sort of primary contact with the unconscious, with the images that form, the myths that form. And it has to be comparative. It has to use history. It has to use the human record comparatively to provide a milieu of understanding. Is that making sense? A little bit? Okay. So, thus, there came this secondary formation or layer of his task. And this secondary undertaking was demanded by what had already happened to him. He had brought this vision to form. That was the primary task. Now he had to develop a scientifically acceptable and historically grounded vocabulary adequate to interpreting human imaginative, visionary, creative text. Both his own and many other examples offered by history. And this hermeneutic, this task, would open new perspectives on the molten magma of human imagination and the primal motifs that crystallized from the voice of the depths, which we call commonly the collective unconscious. Personally, I don't like that word, collective unconscious. The reason I don't like it is it gets used a whole lot without ever people thinking about what they are saying. Okay? Depths. Something about that. It's a little more visceral. Okay? Collective unconscious sounds sort of thinky. Depths. You get the point. Okay. The primary motifs that crystallized from this voice of the depths, that was what he was going to be interpreting. And you know what that included? It includes the symbolic wealth of us we humans, including our religions and our religion-making instincts. Yeah? Do you see what Jung did in his writings thereafter? What was he looking at? What was he interpreting? How was he talking about things? Much of what he was saying was circling back to what had happened to him. He had gained a vocabulary through an experience. He was then bringing that vocabulary into relation to historical manifestations of experience. And you know what? A lot of us have missed that. Over these many years of reading Jung, we've really missed that. Dr. Shyam Dasani, Sonu. Do you guys know who Shyam Dasani is? Do all you guys, like, you're all familiar with that stuff? Yes? No?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay, all right. Yeah, Sonu was the fellow who was locked in a cell for 13 years with Liber Novus, okay? Dr. Shyam Dasani did the first translation, primary translation, all the editorial work on Liber Novus. Starting in 1996, it was published in 2009. Yep, count it up. How many years is that? And you know what? During all that time, he couldn't talk to anybody about what he was doing. Can you imagine being locked in a room for 16 years, reading, interpreting, annotating, translating Liber Novus? Holy mackerel. Okay. But he survived. Barely. So, Dr. Shyam Dasani has referred to this labor as Jung's comparative study of the individuation process. When I say this labor, what do I mean? I mean that looking at visionary products over time. Shyam Dasani says what Jung was doing is he'd gone through this process called the individuation process in Liber Novus. And then he went looking comparatively at examples in other forms of human literature and experience that correlated with what had happened to him. So Shyam Dasani says Jung then began in the 1920s onward into the 40s his comparative study of the individuation process. All right? I call that, I conceive of it as the development of a new hermeneutics, a new interpretive art to human creative vision. And both of these terms, they're contiguous. They really are pointing at the same activity. Personally, I think hermeneutics of vision is sexier. Okay? Less words, more meaning. All right. I did say I was going to talk about Gnosticism, right? Yeah? Okay, we're getting there. I had to lay that hermeneutic background. Alchemy. Jung began his study of alchemy around 1930. And his study and interpretive commentary on alchemy continued for many years thereafter. And I know that some of you, at least some people, have found this alchemical work pretty hard to comprehend. Does that include any of you? It certainly has included me at moments in life. All right. It's left lots of people completely bewildered. In light of Liber Novus, what Jung was doing is finally evident. The anagogic fourth key, he was using to unlock the gate of alchemy is integrally connected to his own visionary experience. Jung had entered this alchemical retort in 1913, and from the alembic he had extracted a stone of experience, formed. Anyone who has spent a few years studying Liber Novus will find there are many reasons within Liber Novus why Jung found a reflection of what he was doing in the alchemical opus. Once you've spent the time with Liber Novus, and believe me, it's not just one reading, it's three or four readings, it's a few winters. And Liber Novus is a book for winter. Okay, let me just put that out, straight out. You do not read Liber Novus in the summer. It is against the rules. You start in October when Jung started, and you follow this through the dark. I mean, if you live in Australia, we can change the rules around for if you're an antipodean, you know, whatever. But Believe me, that's the time. Go into the darkness with the darkness. Come back up with the light. It really makes a difference in how you develop this stuff. Okay? So, in light of Libra Novus, what Jung was doing is evident. After meeting Libra Novus, one reads all of Jung's writings on alchemy with eyes really open in a new way and for the first time. Dr. Shyam Dasani, who has spent more time than any of us pondering Libra Novus, suggests that in considering Jung's study of alchemy, we should now understand, and I quote, the real referent of his alchemical works to not be medieval alchemy, the real referent not to be medieval alchemy per se, but the symbolism of the individuation process. The hermeneutic key, Dr. Shyam Dasani's words, the hermeneutic key that Jung was using to read alchemical texts consisted of his own self-experimentation as presented in Liber Novus. Are those words understandable? Is that getting across? Are you getting that? That was the key, his experience. That gave him the vocabulary of looking at the symbolic stuff and seeing his stuff. Yeah? All right. Okay. Hermeneutics and tradition of Gnosis. This same hermeneutic key opens the door to understanding Jung's repetitive reference to ancient Gnostic texts, documents dating to the beginning of the Christian aeon. His interpretive referent to these texts was his own experience. Again, what I have termed this primary hermeneutics of vision, the effort crystallized in the Red Book, Libra Novus. Other than the works from the alchemical tradition, there's no categorical area of history, of sources, that Jung turned to more frequently in his major writings than the Gnostic texts. To look at the dynamics and contents of the collective unconscious and the constellation of the self. None more common than alchemy than the tradition of the Gnosis. He's quoted in Memories, Dreams, Reflections again as saying, when I began to understand alchemy, I realized that it represented the historical link with Gnosticism. Alchemy was the link with Gnosticism. And that a continuity therefore existed between past and present. Alchemy formed the bridge, on the one hand, into the past, to Gnosticism, and on the other, into the future, to modern psychology of the unconscious. The possibility of a comparison with alchemy and the uninterrupted chain back to Gnosticism gave substance to my psychology. That's Memories, Dreams, Reflections. We've had it around for 50 years. That's on page 201. Okay. Jung saw his life work, his psychology, if one wishes to use that category to circumscribe what was really a complex and expansive vision. A complex and expansive vision. Jung saw his life work as organically connected to a tradition with roots in the experience of Gnosis documented at the beginning of the Christian age. This connection, quote, back to Gnosticism, gave substance, unquote, to his psychology. Substance. Why did it give substance? Why? Why did it give substance? Think about that. Why did this connection make a difference? You see, if the psyche is real, if it is the primordial root, if there are archetypes, primal images of deep human consciousness, or available to, you know, imaginally to human consciousness, if they're there, they are not unique to one person. The word's collective, right? It's not individual. It's collective. They're not unique to one person. They're not unique to one time. The vocabulary with which we speak of them is unique to us and to our social situation, to our cultures, to our reference semantically. Yes, of course. But the image itself, those things, Jung is saying, are primal. And they are shared. They are collective. So when he says substance, he means that here he is finding evidence of his experience. Now look, in 1915, a couple years into Liber Novus, don't you think Dr. Jung was looking for something to hook him up to human tradition and what was going on with him? And he sure wasn't finding a whole lot of it in European culture at that day. And he was not finding it in the company of dear Sigmund Freud. Okay? Where were his friends? Where were the links? Where were the roots that tied him to human experience? This connection back to Gnosticism gave substance to his psychology. It was the deep soil and the bedrock that rooted his life in history. Now, Jung's encounter with the Gnostic texts came before, and I got to emphasize that, before his connections with alchemy. He used alchemical texts as a resource in his later, in his secondary discussion of this collective unconscious, these experiences, starting in 1930. But 15 years before that, Jung had encountered Gnostic vision. And that began in 1915. Jung's encounter with the Gnostic text began in 1915, right in the middle of the Red Book. And Gnostic mythology at that point entangles itself. It became a vocabulary to his experiences and thence entered into the formation of Liber Novus after 1915. This is signally witnessed by a text known as the Seven Sermons to the Dead. Septem Sermones ad Mortuos. The Seven Sermons to the Dead. People have known about these publicly since 1962 or thereabouts, after the publication of Memories, Dreams, Reflections. Privately, they've been known about for almost 100 years minus four. Okay? And the Seven Sermons to the Dead, now as we look at Liber Novus, what we find out is they may be seen in that context as the summary revelation of Liber Novus. It was the only part that he chose to publish and share. If we are to understand more than the this and the that of Jung, if we are ready to circumscribe the whole, we must, at this point in our history, begin to understand both Jung's relationship with the tradition of Gnosis and the nature of the hermeneutics he employed in his usage of its textual remnants. Okay, I'm going to go a little bit long. Did anyone bring tomatoes today? Are there tomatoes in the audience? Oh, thank you. Okay. I'm going to go a little bit...
It's not turkey.
Okay. I'm not going to go over time, but I'm going to leave less. I have two more pages I want to go through. Okay, so let me just do it. Why does this always happen to me? Why do I always do this? It's fate. Jung and Gnosis. Okay. So Dr. Jung associated himself with, and he repeatedly referenced the writings available to him from the ancient tradition of Gnosis. For at least three reasons. Three reasons. One, he felt the ancient Gnostics had done what he had done. They had heard a voice of the depths and crystallized it in mythopoetic form. When he read them, he saw in their writings an image of his own experience. Barbara Hanna stated in her biography of Jung, which some people consider one of the best and most accurate, a lot of it may be gossip, but at least it was first-hand gossip in this case. Barbara Hanna states, Jung told me more than once, the first, and she emphasizes that word, the first parallels he found to his own experience, speaking of Liber Novus, the first parallel he found to his own experiences were in the Gnostic texts, that is, those reported in the writings of Hippolytus, Now, Politus is one of the heresiological writers that Jung was reading in 1915. Jung's reading of Hippolytus and recognition of the Gnostic parallels to his experience apparently began in earnest around 1915. That's 2 years into the Red Book. That's right when he started copying the manuscript on those first parchment pages. The second reason of Jung's association. Jung, the second key. Or second, the hermeneutic key of his own self-experimentation led him to an anagogic reading of the textual legacy of Gnosis. Now, here I said that, anagogic reading. What the hell do I mean by that?
Can you say that whole thing again?
Yeah, I will. Second, of the two reasons, reason number two. Second, the hermeneutic key of his own self-experimentation led him to an anagogic reading of the textual legacy of Gnosis. Jung read the texts with a perception that penetrated to the symbolic content of experience underlying text. See what I mean by anagogic reading? He's not just reading the text as dogma, as a metaphysical statement, as abstruse syncretic philosophy. He's saying, my God, this text is the expression, the crystallization of a human experience of the primal root of the archetypal structure. Is that coming across?
Yeah.
We're making sense here? Okay.
That was only possible for him because he was able to understand the symbolic language.
And why was he able to understand the symbolic language?
Because he had gone through his own journey.
And what are you supposed to do when you come into Jungian analysis, when you want to be a Jungian therapist? What's the first thing you're supposed to do?
To experience. To live.
And why do you think Dr. Jung would have thought that experience was important? Because if you're going to interpret this stuff, you better damn well know the vocabulary by your experience, right? How could you possibly relate to another person's entry into that if you haven't entered yourself? You know, look, in Jung's day, there were no tests, no exams, right? What there was? What Jung had one criteria for a person ready to work as an analyst, and it could come after 3 months of working with Dr. Jung. And what was that? One criteria. They know the psyche is real. That's where it started. That was it. That was the key. When you've met it, when you know it's real, that is the key. And it darn well still should be the key. Despite whatever you can do on a test, that is the key. Okay? So look, neither of those perceptions are particularly unique. You know, the Gnostics were doing what he was doing, and they were seeing and contextualizing it as he was. So Jung thought. Jung had experienced a similar constellation of archetypal images and now found evidence of their universality. Evidence of their universality in the documents of the Gnosis. And look, we're going to, you know, these next two nights, that's what we're going to be discussing. This is the background. We're going to be discussing those motifs. What were those myths? What were they? Where are they in the Red Book? Where are they in Jung's later work? Okay? So neither of those statements are unique perceptions. But there's a third reason behind Jung's interest in the Gnosis. And this has to date not received any attention. I don't think I've heard anyone ever say it. And it sets classical Gnosticism, what happened at the dawning of the Christian aeon in the Gnostic movement, in a unique category relative to other later manifestations of Gnostic tradition. And Jung identified those to be in Hermeticism, in alchemy, in Christian mysticism in the Middle Ages, particularly Meister Eckhart. And what is that? Not only had the Gnostics done what Jung had done, and not only had they seen what Jung had seen, but they had done it. They had undergone the experiences of this mythopoetic power underlying consciousness at an extraordinary moment in human history. An extraordinary moment in human history. A moment in the evolution of human consciousness, which Jung identified as the threshold of a new aeon, the aeon of Pisces, the Christian age. Okay? And so had Dr. Jung, or so he supposed, because Dr. Jung felt he stood, we stand together at the threshold of a similar crossing point in human consciousness. This is Jung's story. I know this is strange to some people, but you cannot read Ion or much of Jung's work after 1944 without realizing that Jung thought that we were at the beginning of a new age of human consciousness. And this is not something about which we should stand up and cheer and smile, because it is a time of dissolution. It is a time of terrible, terrible challenge and danger. There are some letters he wrote late in life that are just, you know, he talks about, you know, I'm a grandfather, you know, many times over, and I think of my children living into this new coming age and the darkness of this transition point. What was the light? The light was the primordial depths. The light was the voice within us. I mean, unless we listened to something other than the voice of this times, we were in big trouble. Okay. All right. So, just to finish, let me tell you a story. It's called Break a Leg. I got to explain. During the first week of February, this week, in this cold weather, 69 years ago, Dr. Jung, who was then 68 and a half years old, and in vigorous health, so he thought, took a walk up the hill here, about 5 blocks from here. And it was sort of cold, and he slipped on the ice and he broke his ankle. Modest injury. Went to the doctor, they put him in a cast that was a bit too tight. They told him he had to stay at complete immobilization, which of course he did while smoking his pipe. Over the subsequent days, he had a complication, a common complication actually, a venous thrombus, a blood clot formed in the vein of his leg. And 11 days later, the blood clot broke loose, traveled up through his heart into his lung, and Dr. Jung had a catastrophic pulmonary embolism. And he nearly died. Over the years, 35 years, I've cared for many patients who have been in this situation, and it is a frightening and a catastrophic and a life-threatening event. And in Dr. Jung's day, there was no treatment. None. And he hung.
How was he treated? Because the embolia doesn't go alone.
They watched him. There was no treatment. There was no effective treatment. I mean, they may give him some sedatives, some morphine, nitroglycerin maybe, oxygen. That was it. There really was no treatment. In fact, now, I mean, the treatment now is we use what are called thrombolytics in extreme cases like Dr. Jung's, or we use blood thinners to try to, you know, dissolve clot or keep more from forming. Those were not available. They were unknown in 1944. So what do? You do what doctors used to do. You prognosticate. You say, well, this is serious. Chances are he's going to die. That's actually all doctors could do, is prognosticate once upon a time. You made a diagnosis and you gave a prognosis. Sometimes you gave a prescription, but sometimes the prescription didn't make any difference in the prognosis, right?
Even now,
yeah. Are you criticizing my specialty, madam? Yeah, he was in the hospital. He hung between life and death for 3 weeks. He was hospitalized for much longer, and he convalesced for almost a year and a half thereafter. He did hardly anything for a year and a half. He really almost died. At the threshold of death. And this is in Memories, Dreams, Reflections. Just go home and read it. This is important reading, really important reading. At the threshold of death, Dr. Jung experienced a series of visions. Okay? Visions. visions of a wedding, a sacred wedding, a hieros kamos. He said, and this is in Memory Stream's Reflections, you can read it. I quote, "It is impossible to convey the beauty and the intensity of emotion during those visions. They are the most tremendous things I have ever experienced. They are the most tremendous things I've ever experienced." This is Jung talking. Are you kidding? At that point, the most I've ever experienced. "I would have never imagined that any such experience was possible. It was not a product of imagination. The visions and experiences were utterly real. There was nothing subjective about them. They all had a quality of absolute objectivity." We shy away from the word eternal, but I can describe the experience only as the ecstasy of a non-temporal state in which present, past, and future are one. Everything that happens in time had been brought together into a concrete whole. Nothing was distributed over time. Nothing could be measured by temporal concepts. End quote. Barbara Hanna compared this to Jung's second initiation, the first having been his visions in Liber Novus. These visions at the threshold of death changed Jung, changed him. They oriented his final works. And now he knew he had to say things he had never said before. He had to speak unspoken things, the unspoken message of Liber Novus. This is what he said in an interview late in life, a private interview, now published. This manuscript's hard to find, but it'll be in your library. And this is his quote. "Before my illness, I had often asked myself if I were permitted to publish or even speak of my secret knowledge. I set it all down in Ion," his book, Ion. "I set it all down in Ion. I realized it was my duty to communicate these thoughts, yet I doubted whether I was allowed to give expression to them. During my illness, I received confirmation." End quote. Okay? What was Jung's secret knowledge? Let me just put in a footnote here. Ion was written starting in the fall of 1947. He was corresponding very intimately with Victor White during this period, and the beginnings of Ion are well documented in his letters with Father Victor White, which have now been published as the Jung-White letters, beautifully edited by Ann Lammers. And that also, believe me, will be in your library here at the Institute and should be in your personal library. Okay.
Sorry, which year did he have the thrombosis?
That happened in February 44. He was in convalescent for almost a year. And then in November of 46, he had another serious cardiac event. It's described as a heart attack, whether it was a heart attack or something else, I don't know. It was not as serious, but it was serious enough. So he was really just coming out of convalescence from that first event. November 46, he has a second event, and then he's in convalescing for another 6 months. Once again, there's really no treatment. It's just like, do you live, don't you? Do you get better, don't you? Okay. Go read that section, Memories, Dreams, Reflections. It is just a knockout section. Jung said he was an empiricist, right? How many times did he say he was an empiricist? This was his empirical experience. He said, "I never believed such experiences were possible." Dr. Jung was not much into belief. He knew. Now he knew. Okay, Ion. The first full work that emerged after his convalescence was Ion, and he started writing it in the fall of 47. In title and content, Ion returned to Liber Novus, to the first folio page of Liber Novus. Certainly no page of Liber Novus was more carefully considered than its beginning. Though this is the first leaf artistically rendered, it is in composition a conclusion, a summary statement made about all that follows. As Jung explained in the text on the verso of that sheet, "I speak in images. With nothing else can I express the words from the depths." And the words carefully chosen for the beginning are not, however, his own, nor are they found in Jung's draft manuscript. For a preface to this revelation, Jung reached back across two millennia to the echoes and preface of an antecedent but parallel moment in the story. There, scribed in Latin, he authored prophetic writings from the threshold of the Christian age. Three readings, three auguries of the new age from the prophet Isaiah, and the signal proclamation of that age's birth, as recorded in the Gospel of John, and the Word was made flesh. Worked around this prologue of a prior and passing aeon, 2,000 years ago, Jung added an image of his own declaration of the new. Go look at the first page of Liber Novus. Look at the top of that page. The key figure is a depiction of the sun's precession through the zodiacal circle. Astrological observations linked past human story, the vast human story, with the gradual shifting equinoctial position of the sun relative to the fixed stars, a transposition within the zodiac marked every 2,200 years or so. At the dawn of Christianity, the sun had entered the astrological house of Pisces, the age of the fish. Now the solar spring point is on the cusp of transitioning into the zodiacal constellation of Aquarius, inaugurating a new age. That's the first page of Liber Novus. Within the first four words of Liber Novus, which are Der Weg des Kommenden. Der Weg des Kommenden. The way of the coming. The way of what is to come. During the first four words, Jung intertwined a graphic tale of the past and a prophecy of the future. He said, I speak in images. With nothing else can I express the words from the depth. The preface declaration of the new book offers, in complex image, the mythopoetic proclamation of a new and coming age, an epical turning point in the human story. This is Jung's summary perspective on Liber Novus as it was formed in 1915. The story and its revelation are the cornerstone of his book, Aeon, the dawning of a new aeon. This was the signal revelation Jung had derived from Liber Novus, and it was disclosed in word and image on its first page. It was the way to come. This transition of an aeon was a momentous event in the evolution of human consciousness. It is a time of dissolution, of turmoil, and psychic activation. And the depths have something to say. And the words from the depths are living symbols. So this is a kairos. Jung stated that our age, like that of two millennia ago, is at a kairos, a great and propitious time. Our moment in time is part of a story projected long ago into the stars. We are now starting the fourth chapter. The fourth chapter. Four. We are now at the beginning of the age of Aquarius, according to Dr. Jung's story. At a similar threshold of transformation, 2,000 years ago, Jung heard, echoing across history, visionary voices of the Gnostics. And he found in their myth a reflection of his myth. They had lived at a similar moment of great aeonial transformation. This really connected Jung to their experience of the depths at that time. He found in their myth a reflection of his own in his own time. And so tomorrow, we're going to look at some of those mythic components. This was the introduction. And so you know what? I'm done. Thank you.